In 3, 2, 1.
My name is Bob Jackson. I'm a buffalo farmer, former ranger. This is the Prairie Farm Podcast.
Okay, so you never actually got terminated. You got served papers several times of termination. You worked through that, somehow made a connection with Chuck Grassley and made papers in Europe and all kinds of crazy stuff. But you finally retire at 57 because they said you were too old to be shooting bad guys anymore. Which, I mean, we're with you now 20 years later, and that I am sure is not the case, hanging out with you. But you come back to the farm. You've already had buffalo here. What's going on with the buffalo here?
One thing first, to talking what you just said, retired, if you could call that. But I spent 33 years, but I don't get any government retirement because I was only I turned into just working 5 months a year, and so you can't get to, so I don't have any retirement, so to speak. I had a half a day of sick leave in 33 years. I was good shape all those years. Hmm. I could have had 2-3 years where I didn't even work, just building up sick leave. Senator Grassley, after I was through, he said he could get me a job with the Department of Defense for like 2 years, and then I'd have all of my retirement. But too much to do here on the farm with buffalo. So I appreciated his offer to get, because he was a chairman of the Department of Defense committee there. He actually was really, really good. When I went to Washington, D.C., he was chairing something on the Senate floor, and they took a recess, you know, where he could get pictures with me, and all the senators were thinking, whoa, you know, who's this guy out there? That's that important. Because they were talking health food or health, not food, but health crisis going on with all the hospitals and stuff. So it was an important thing. And I knew it was important when he met with me in his office and the Iowa Farm Bureau had come out for their annual meeting, and they had to talk with Grassley's chief of staff, not Grassley, because Grassley was talking with me. So it was really important for him. They say that I was probably his most important, appreciated by him, whistleblower. I wasn't a whistleblower, but he does appreciate people that stand up for what they should be. So I guess I could say I'm more of a Democrat than I am a Republican as far as leanings, but I definitely think Grassley was very honest, very good, and he is willing to take on people within his own party. So ask me the question again. I just had
you
to say a little
good.
Bit.
Yeah. That is shocking. Usually people on the other side of the aisle don't sing praise for someone. And, you know, Grassley, everyone in Iowa, you either love them or hate them, and it seems like it's either you're Republican or Democrat, but you might be the first one. Not that We Kent and I have to say this all the time. We're not a political podcast, but we get sucked into politics sometimes. You know, when we feel like talking about. But you had come back here. You said you couldn't work for Grassley because there was too much to do on the farm. What was there to do on the farm? What were the buffalo doing?
Well, what was good about buffalo? You could go when I had like 100 buffalo here. You know, I might be back from Yellowstone after 5 months, and it might be 2 weeks before you go out there to see the buffalo. They take care of themselves. What we usually did, excuse me, is have a, you have to burp that out. What they usually did, we had like a high school kid was graduating. His family was, you know, parents were close by. They just stay in our house, and they just have to put mineral out and then change the pastures. And that's all you had to do. So it was nice seeing buffalo, but you didn't really have to be with them. They could have all their calves. They could do everything that way. In fact, what you guys probably already know, But if you have grazers, cattle, buffalo, whatever, on native grasses, and especially the forbs too, but the native grasses, your mineral cost is about half as much because those plants are reaching down so much deeper, the roots are, and they're bringing up the mineral. So anybody with cattle on native prairie or reintroduced is going to have a lot less.
So that's like one of the advantages of having warm season grasses in with their cool season grasses is the value of the
supplements. When they're eating our native, about half of our place has never been plowed. That's 700
that
and some
really
acres.
Cool.
Yeah, that's, and we got 400-year-old oak savanna trees out there.
Wow.
That's awesome.
Which I feel like Iowa has only been alive for 200 years. Crazy to remember that there were things here 400 years ago.
Yeah.
If we have time to go out through here, and I appreciate anybody who wants to come out and see this place. When Brother John would come down here hunting with his friend that owned Aqua Sleep World, it's the last stronghold of any of the native, and maybe if you get northeast Iowa, but this is a little area in through here that, you know, it was more cattle country, people thought, because northern Iowa and central Iowa was row crop, and you get down into Missouri further, and, you know, you get your woods and everything else, so this was in fact, the south and north fork of the Sheraton River in the 30s, they thought about making that a forest preserve and a prairie preserve.
Wow.
And, of course, it was it came real close in Congress to getting approved, and it would have been then put into a national monument. Of course, the insurance companies were the ones mainly promoting it, kind of like Yellowstone, the railroad owners were the ones wanting Yellowstone.
Is this... Stephen State Forest, how far are you from that?
Yeah, that's right up here on the South Fork, 20 miles away. That's what Stephen State Forest is. And that was planted during the 30s, I think, is what
was.
Yeah, it was all that CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps, all that Roosevelt. In fact, I just found out here one of my farmer friends here, his dad talked about in the 30s, where all the local guys working for CCC, they would build outhouses for all the farmers. Mystic, Iowa over here. Yeah. Not too far, is it? This is real coal country here.
Hmm.
Yeah, they have a creek going through town. And kind of like that movie Hateful Eight or whatever, where where he's sitting over, he's in an outhouse and it's elevated up. Well, the town of Mystic over here, they had all the outhouses on a plank going out, and it was right over the stream. And so they let her go down the stream.
Yeah. I hope it was on the end of town and doesn't have to drive
all the way through town.
Oh, no.
That's what they did. No. Yeah, so in a way, it was really, you could say, a relic of the past, which included some of that, but it also meant that you had a lot of hillsides that never were plowed. The worst thing I ever saw here, a neighbor here a couple miles from here, because we're on the South Fork of the Sheraton, which means hillier country, and that's why we have some of our land that hasn't been plowed. But we were taking his son to junior high basketball or whatever, you know, because they didn't have enough money to keep him going, you know, where they'd be driving him to school. And so we would pick him up. And the guy was plowing down the steepest hill. It was all prairie. It was way too steep to even farm with mules. And then he would circle around, and then he would plow down that slope again. Then he'd circle around and keep plowing it. And so the next time I asked him, I says, "Why are you plowing that hill? You know, you can't get anything off of it. You can't plant it." And he says, "Well, lower down on that hill, all the topsoil's gone. And I figure if I can plow this hillside, then all that topsoil will run down onto the land that..."
Wow.
Yeah, that's
what... Well, he's right. That will happen.
Yeah, that is true.
Yeah, some of the prairie here is just out of... it's just because it was left because it wasn't. But then I just found out a couple of weeks ago, the Soil Conservation Service, in the 50s and the 60s, they paid to aerial spray all the sumac, all these areas with the brush and everything to kill it out. Hmm. And then 3 to 4 years later, with all the dead trees and all the dead brush, then they could, you know, claim it back again, burn it all up, and then start farming it. Hmm. So it was like something the Soil Conservation Service did back then wasn't too good. No, you know, you always hear about the Motiflora rose and things like that, but that wasn't a very good thing for them to do, but that was then. And during the 30s, heck, all that CCC stuff, I think that was really good. I think it'd be great if they put that back in. Hmm. It'd help a lot of these young people out.
What, yeah. Put what back in?
The CCC.
The CC, Civilian Conservation. Yep. You know, where the community projects, you know, yep. the environmental type of things. Yeah. Yep. There's no support for you guys that I know of. The prairie plantings, you know, you get all the ones with the cover crops and everything, but nothing with the permanents. And
no.
I think we're missing out. I mean,
well, yeah, the cover crops things makes the, you know, public sounds good. You know, the farmers are doing a good job with cover crops, but, you know, it's really not getting to the nitty gritty of things, really, about the erosion and, you know, pesticides and herbicides. And
I'll show you guys a 20 acre field over where we call Three Forks. It's got three streams going through it, 280 acres. And there's one field of fescue, and that was planted to corn, trees cut off and everything back in the 60s. And I still get government payments for not planting corn. I mean, it's just fescue. I mean, it's not much, but that's what the program goes for. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's not. It's
not even a native plant.
Yeah, not even native. It's just fescue. Yeah.
Man. So you have native on this land, and you're saying that a big part of the reason it's been preserved is because it's not as good of the ground as northern Iowa, central Iowa, for sure not, you know, northeast and northwest or northwest Iowa. But what about your bison you have here? You originally had bison up north, and did you just ship them all down here because this was better ground for them, or what did you do there?
Well, actually, it was my two brothers and I that first bought this first 100 acres, and we all owned the buffalo together. John, you know, Aqua Sleep World, John's Waterbeds, and then he went to the Crystal Mines, owning Crystal Mines down in Arkansas. My older brother was in professorship, you know, he did at Iowa State, and DMAC too. And so eventually it was, I moved here, you know, permanent. And so it became less and less with them and then more with me. But it worked in really good. That's why I didn't work any more winters in Yellowstone starting in 82, because this was becoming an occupation as well as, you know, something I had in Yellowstone. I loved Yellowstone. I could live like it was 200-300 years before. I wasn't going back, but at the same time, I could enjoy it. And here on the farm with all the native grasses and what you found out from Yellowstone, looking at those buffalo there, because some of my area was Hayden Valley, Pelican Valley, big buffalo areas. And then the scalp bowls and that would come down along the lake into the area where I was a lot of time. So you notice they're all in family groups. My degrees, fish and wildlife, all biologists about game wardens, they think of herds as a multiple of one. They don't think of them as extended families. Yeah. And it all that is that way. All grazers are that way. So a lot of these lands here we got are woods too. I still don't know what some of those buffalo are eating in there. I went there 2 days ago and they're all down in the woods like they are in the spring. I don't know what they're eating, but that's a learned experience. All grazers are what you call herbivores. Like humans are omnivores. We can eat instinctively meat, but from the plant community, that's a learned behavior. Like I say, grizzlies have to be at their mothers for 2 years, otherwise they'll die. And grazers, they can eat grass instinctively. But to harvest from the broadleaf community, which you get into something like eastern tall grass, eastern United States, then it's mostly forbs. Hmm. And everybody thinks that that's not something they can eat. And it isn't a top-down. Unless you got alfalfa or clover, European ancient plants, that's top-down grazer, all your native forbs, which are so important That's a harvesting. You know the flower buds, a whirl of milkweed leaves, at a certain time of year. What those buffalo are eating in the woods right now. That's a learned experience, and that's passed down through generations. That's the herbivore part of it. Herbs. You don't think of grass as herbs. That's the broadleaf community. And then you find out, like my older brother, he did, as part of his studies of fish and wildlife, he took a summer job in Illinois, and they counted, like, the number of pheasant nests. They do it in switchgrass, and they do it in native. And there's so much more pheasant nests in the native. And why? Because all the insects, he told me, they can't live. When you have beaten down rain in grass, there's not enough leaf cover, and all those insects get killed. They get pounded out. But if you got forbs, then all the insects are there, and all the little pheasants, they can eat all that. They have to have the insects, and you can't do that with grass.
Yeah.
And so everybody here in the 70s, they started putting in Indian grass, big blue stem. You got to have the forbs. And so what our buffalo have learned as family groups is that they harvest from the broadleaf community. We had a couple old bachelors here, our neighbors, and they'd watch our buffalo a lot. And they said, we see you're eating, your buffalo eating those locust pods. See, that's a legume, it's a tree, thorns, but they have really nutritious locust pods. The Indians would strip them and eat the seeds as well as the milky part of it. And he says, I see your buffalo are eating those locust pods. He says, once in a while we'll have an old cow that'll eat those. And you see, it took that cow that long to learn to eat it, 10, 12 years old. But none of it's passed on because the calves are all put in the feedlots, unless for a few replacement cows, that's all you'd have. So if you had the information, you know, what you can eat passed on, we shouldn't be able to have near that many buffalo. 300, 350 buffalo on 700 acres. But they're getting a lot out of all those fringe areas. And they're getting a lot on the prairie plants. And you don't really notice it. Everybody tries to do the mass grazing, you know, where they put them in real tight little areas where they pound everything out, and you can get more forbs that way. But that's not the same. It's not the same thing. Buffalo extended families, they graze tight. These neighbor guys, bachelors, said, we see your buffalo go across, and they'll circle across that 100-acre pasture, you see. And he said, they're like a mowing machine. They're all tight together. And they're all mowing across there. And then they come back through the next day. And I hadn't really noticed that. But that's what you see in Yellowstone, too. Everybody has, like, creep feed for their, once the calves are weaned, because they can't get enough nutrition. Well, in Yellowstone, in our herd, when they're grazing, all the young yearlings are in front. Your lead cows are in the middle. Your most nutritious vegetation is going to the ones that need it the most. And then you have your bull groups. Everybody thinks a bull is just there for breeding, but your bull groups in the wild are like 40% males. And you see your males, whether it's beef bulls or buffalo, they eat the coarse vegetation. So when you're eating the coarse vegetation and a bunch of them together eating it, then you get succulent coming in, and then you get your cow-calf group that's needing that. And so it's so important to have, and it's so much more efficient. We did a grant proposal for, as part of BEHAVE. It's a range science initiative out of Utah State. And we put a $2 million grant up. And I was principal in that. They'd fly me out there for advice on how to write this thing up because they didn't know any of this stuff. And everything they had was symptom management for range science. Again, they think of animals as a herd of multiples of one. It's a herd density, as they think of. But if you have cattle that are passed on the generations, then what you have is an animal. Everybody's afraid of riparian areas, overgrazing, you know, damage of the streams. But no family. If the humans, you don't ever have a family in a downtown area. Same way as the animals, the grazers. if everybody's using that stream, all the families, you don't park there. You get your drink and you go back. Some of those accounts, they'd be trotting for a day to get to water, then they'd head back.
Wow.
So they wanted to use this information for beef herds in all that BLM, Forest Service, all that government land. And
BLM
came,
here standing for Bureau of Land Management.
Bureau of Land Management, yeah. And they have a lot of lands out west. And so the grazing is entirely different with your buffalo or if you had it with cattle. We tried to find a herd of wild cattle anywhere in the world that we could use as a show of what animals, grazers that are in families, beef. And we finally found one off the Alaskan islands. They'd been Herefords that had been, the ranchers couldn't make a go of it. So they just left in the 60s. And that Hereford herd is all turned into, you know, all the grazing, you know, extended families.
Wow.
We found out too late, but it would have been too hard to study them there. And since then, they've been butchering the hell out of them with the ships coming in and getting all the hamburger off of those islands.
So what I'm hearing from you is that buffalo have an extended family. Like, they connect, and that actually affects their feeding habits, whereas cattle, when we have cattle, they're really... In your writings, you wrote a lot, a dysfunctional family, right? They're a bunch of different, just random cattle put together in the same pen. Bulls are used just for breeding and basically nothing else. But you found one, only one that you could find in the whole world, a semi-wild herd of cattle that had created their own family. How long does it take a bunch of strange bison, and like strangers as in, or alien to each other, how long does it take to get them to become a family? Did you buy yours as already a family unit, or?
No. We started out, what did we start out? I think my brother John and I, three animals, right? One little buffalo bull, Billy we called him, and then we had... three animals we started out. So everybody starts out, and they can develop. It's only when they start butchering them, then they become dysfunctional. Ours, we got up to 100 head. And so they had a pretty good chance. I didn't have to butcher them right away. So we had 100 head before we started having to, you know, figure out how you're going to actually raise and then harvest them. All grazers, elephants, Cape buffalo, elk, the Indians would hunt elk herds of up to 300. That's the max you can have for independent, you know, recognition. Chimpanzees, elephants, everything is a max of interactive recognition. It doesn't matter what you think of brains. That's what it is.
So you're saying the extended families of these grazers only ever went up to 300 in number.
Once you get to the level of, you can't have interactive recognition, then you may have associates, one that might, they're kind of like diplomats. They may know who that other herd is. But a cohort herd is a lot different. Kind of like if you go to the Iowa State basketball tournament and you see all these towns with all the, you know, their basketball teams that are attending the state tournament, you know, maybe not participating, and all those guys clump together and they go around, but they all go back home to their homes. Those are cohorts together. So people with cattle, they can bring in one bunch from a ranch, bring in another bunch, and they go through the work shoots and they find out they're all from that same bunch. That's a cohort. That's dysfunctional. So how long does it take? 12 to 15 years. To get a functional family with the support systems. They could do it with cattle. They could do it with buffalo. 95% of the buffalo in this country end up in feedlots. There is no functional. We're the only herd in the world that raises grazing animals in extended family management. We're it in the whole world that I know about.
Wow.
That is crazy. You said that they become dysfunctional when you start slaughtering them or you start butchering them. How do you stop that now? Like, you have a few hundred head of buffalo. how do you go in and just kill some of them and then the others aren't dysfunctional?
Extended families are, you know, how do they spin off? What I call them is power groups. You may have 50 or 60, maybe 70 animals in a power group, the infrastructure core. Then you have spinoff families. And that's in Yellowstone or in Iowa. What you'll see is like seven or eight main cows with their dependents, two-year-olds, yearlings, calves. And then you'll see two young bulls, five-year-old and four-year-old. They're the ones, the only ones that can stay with female groups. Most of the breeding in Yellowstone is from six to eight-year-old bulls. But they can't stay with that family unit, that matriarchal unit, year-round. They got to provide the protection. So it's the young bulls that are the best and the greatest of all. It's the same thing as Indians. When they split off, it was always some young, vital, young bucks, and then they would split off. Hunter-gatherer societies is exactly the same thing as what buffalo. In fact, the Indian tribes in the plains that had problems, something social in their makeup, were having problems. They always had a couple guys that were experts in buffalo. They would study the buffalo herds for a couple weeks with that specific problem, and then they would incorporate that into their tribe. It's all exactly the same. So do you start with a dysfunctional bunch and try to make them functional? And it's kind of like if you have a bunch of dopers that, you know, had really screwed up families, do you try to make them functional or do you start with new? I don't know which one. But I look at it as if you have three towns, do you take out the infrastructure of all three towns and screw them up? Or do you take out one town entirely and then have the other two towns absorb that resource? So your question is, how do you get a functional group? Dysfunctional, do you take dysfunctional and try to make them functional? Or do you take functional, start it up where you have to have all the support systems in place. That means grandmothers, aunts, uncles. Everything has to be a part of that. All the support groups. As humans, we got schools, we got law enforcement, we got all those artificial support groups that are there. These animals don't have any option like that. They have to have it within their own. So the advantage for us is that we can take bulls 10, 12, 15, 20 years old, we can take cows. And they can, without the stress, see, without the support system, stress builds up incrementally the older you get. So you get tight muscles. You get tough meat. But if they don't have the stress, then we can butcher all those animals. So we can take out all family groups.
Wow.
A whole matriarchal unit.
So like 60 head? Is what you're saying?
Can.
Like a power group?
Yeah. You can take, usually you keep your power group there, your core group.
Okay.
Then you take your spin-off family groups. We either butcher family groups, maybe 25 or 30 will split off. About that. Every fall they'll split off another pod. Then we sell those as starter herds for others who want to have buffalo where they have function already.
Wow.
Or you butcher them. Or you can butcher bull groups. Bulls will be just like a bunch of guys playing cards or whatever. I did want to regress a little bit, digress. You have to have those young bulls with a matriarchal unit, whether it's elk or like Lewis and Clark talked about antelope, where they'd see maybe 25 antelope together, and there's always one or two bulls with them. Those are spinoff groups that can stay with them. But it's like right now as guys, if we tried to stay in a daycare center, we go crazy in a day.
Yeah.
we don't have that kind of energy. So in order for a 6 to 8 year old bull, 10 year old, that's doing a lot of the breeding, they can't stay with a spinoff group that needs all that support of males there year round. They can't do it. So we sell those or you butcher them. But what you find out, you read all the books on all the different hunter-gatherer societies, whether it's in South America, Africa, there's a lot more information out of Africa than hunter-gatherer types. And then, of course, the Indians here. you sell the different age animals and the sexes depending on what the need is for that human population. So everybody thinks a very young animal, like Ted Turner, he's always eaten a yearling cow, female, each year. But there isn't near as much nutrition in one of those animals. But your elder population of humans, or you're very young, digestion is more important than nutrition. And so the Indians, when they'd have a surround, maybe kill 200, then they would take back to the elderly people or the very young the yearling, because that was soft meat, real soft. Mm. It's kind of like your grandmother. You know, she got really floppy triceps. That's soft meat.
So is that more of a delicacy?
No, it's, to them, that they don't have the teeth. They don't have, it's kind of like I'm missing some teeth. to get it digested down is more important than maximum nutrition. No body can concentrate nutrients until growth stops. Mm. So the active age hunter-gatherer society, whether it's males or females, they ate the mature buffalo, elk, whatever you have, because that's where maximum nutrition is. So all of our active age people, the triathletes, those staying in shape, they get the mature cow or male. All of our oldest, the most mature males, they all go to our mixed martial arts. They go to the Mr. Iowas. That's your most nutrients of all. And again, you select what part of that animal you need. We sell quarters of meat. The most nutrition is in your front quarters. You know, the old mountain man accounts would talk about they be in streams, beaver trapping. And, you know, they're in cold streams, no hip boots back then. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't get out of the sack in the morning. After a couple of weeks, their joints and their legs would be so stiff. And they're already eating 4 to 5, 6 pounds of buffalo meat a day. And the Indians would tell them, no, you got to eat what, I don't know what the word was, but your broth. So then they would have all the broth bones, and they'd keep heating that up. And within a couple weeks, they were back, all their joints were good. And so the front quarters got more broth bones, soup bones in it. And so our people with arthritis, people like that, that have, you know, can't move as well, they're all doing the broth, you know, the crock pots or whatever else. And they don't have to take the arthritis medicine near as much anymore.
Wow.
So see, your broth bones, it's got all the collagen, all that connective tissue, and that's all melted. And you don't have to just drink it. Put it with anything, you know, with your rice, with your spaghetti, your macaroni, you know, half of that and with water. And then you're not just drinking broth.
Yeah.
But that's
the flavor in your macaroni. That actually sounds delicious. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So
I hope my wife listens to this.
Yeah. So, anyway, so you match up, and that's what took a lot of years. If you're in the regular bison business, they'll give you the best money if you got two-year-olds. Once you get into 4, 6-year-old animals, those are called call cows or call bulls.
Okay.
Bull is hamburger meat. It's not that way. It's not what it should be.
And you're saying that the meat gets tougher because they don't have family support systems.
They got stress. So they don't have any support systems. Man. And the stress builds up incrementally. The older you get, the more dysfunctional they are, and the more the tight muscles you have.
You heard it here first, folks. If you are stressed a lot, you taste worse. So,
Well, I'll give you a point. The cannibals of what is now Florida, what do you think was their favorite part to eat of a human?
I don't even want to guess at that. I'm going to say brains.
What?
Brains.
Well, brains were always a biggie, of course. That's African. There's cannibal tribes, and they'd always cut the head in two, and they'd scoop out the brains. In fact, my dad loved best when he was young. Eggs and brains. But anyway, what do you think is the most used part of a body, whether it's a human or animal?
The butt.
That has the most nutrition.
No, the butt.
Your fingers, your hands, your wrist and your forearms. That's what the cannibals would eat first. They would have humans that they would finish out, and then they would eat them. They would have them tied up all the time. This is in Florida. Yeah, and so just like cattle, you finish them out, they finish out humans. But that's the first thing they eat. If you get into the Chinese culture, what did they eat the most? It was chicken feet. That's where most nutrition. Yeah. But, of course, all the chicken feet now are from animals, chickens that are so huge, you know, they can't even stand up because they're making such a big breast.
Our one of our co-hosts, Peyton, he does, his parents used to have chickens, and they had to put they used to have the water and the food in the shade, and the chickens would just eat till they broke their legs. So they had to put the water and the food out in the sun so the chickens would have to get up and walk back to the shade just to make sure they didn't just sit there and eat until they
blob out. Yeah. Yeah. So, but, and I had a girlfriend for 10, 11 years. She grew up in New York City, great Asian gal. And they still go for the chicken feet, but the chicken feet aren't anything like what they used to be where the farmers had their longhorn leg horns out there. Now they had to genetically make the feet so they're so huge to support that body. And being in a confinement and they're raising them so fast that the feet don't have near the nutrition. My dad, what his favorite was pig feet. A pig's foot was the cartilage of the foot, huge amount of nutrition. The Indians like that, African hunter-gatherers did, huge amount of nutrition in it. But that's before they've had the confinement. Animal that grows so much faster.
Yeah.
When my dad's funeral, then we had the food and we had all these jars of pickled pig's feet. not the same thing, but it was a tribute to dad is what we had. So you have the part of the body that's used the most. The only thing that's on the hind quarter that's used more than something in the front quarter is the tail, the ox tail. So that is what the Asians, everybody appreciated first. Otherwise, it's your front quarters. And so you match up the person, what their physical needs are, their age, to that different ages of the population of your buffalo, of that extended family. So you might have a mother and father living, an elderly couple. We usually limit to one quarter per customer. The younger couple, they're caretaking. So we'll give them like a 4 to 6 year old buffalo, a half a quarter from that. And then the elderly couple, either very young or a very old cow, because digestion is most important for them. And they're getting the broth from that front quarter. So it's always a front quarter, but it's so they have the broth bones. So that's how you match up. And that took a lot of decades for me to figure that out, what they were doing.
I mean, that's fascinating because not only are you matching the correct part of the buffalo for the nutrition that's needed, but you're saying the buffalo used to match the correct nutrition from plants for their family. Is that correct? Like different parts of the family, depending on how old they were, how mature, what sex they were. They would eat, they would go out and pick different things. And so who's teaching them how to do that?
It's a generational learning from great-grandmother to grandmother to mother to daughter to son. But what you find out, because if we're going to sell a family group to a dysfunctional herd, you have to make sure the young males are there. Because the young males are the ones that are going to find out something new to eat. It's no different than my uncle was a missionary with the Dravidian headhunters in Ecuador. And they wrote accounts like the Aka Indians that killed the missionaries. My uncle was the one that led the military in for those speared bodies. And so then they studied the Akas. And the young boys were the ones that would try any new food. That's the same as your buffalo, your elk. Your young males are the ones that try out new foods.
That's interesting.
So they have to have that part. And so if the young males are there as a spinoff group, they're the ones that are going to search out the new food. And why is it a young male? because they're expendable. If they choose something that's not good for you, you know, they're going to feel it. They're the ones expendable.
It doesn't have anything to do with our frontal cortex not developing all the way.
Yeah, that could be, yeah. I can tell you, unless it's a huge vine, you're not going to find any, well, you got different things out there. But any poison ivy, they'll eat the hell out of it. Mm. So a lot of that stuff. And you don't have ticks on buffalo because they have such fine hair. So they're not draining a lot of the blood out of there. But so there are some advantages nutrition-wise for humans that these buffalo are going to have where they're not stressed as much. But with ours, each year they get less pink eye. It's being bred out. Same way for worms. Over time, the generation, which now in the beef industry, they're saying just don't do a blanket worming, you know, because you're taking all of the resistance out from the genetics. And so if you have animals generation after generation, 12 to 15 years if you're starting from scratch. If you're doing pigs, you know, they have more generations. If you're doing sheep, it doesn't take as long. If you're doing cattle, they mature a year younger than buffalo. So maybe 10 to 12 years is what it'll take to get a functional. Whoever starts it with beef, they're going to make a lot more money than we ever are. They're going to, because they got a lot more of a market out there for beef.
What? Yeah. So buffalo tends to be twice the price of beef per pound. Why? If you're saying that buffalo actually need a lot less attention, they just need some good resources, why is it more expensive?
For one, and we try not to. What they're trying to do in the buffalo business is they're trying to make a less size head on them genetically. They want a head that's half the size of what it is now. You say, why is it more expensive? They got a huge head on them that the packers can't do anything with. That's part of it. They also don't mature. They don't start out. They don't get to their 1,000 pounds near as fast as a beef. But what original Longhorn beef, when they brought them up on the trail going north from Texas, they're only 600 pounds. And that was a 3 to 4 year old. So what they've done in the beef industry, they keep talking about how quick they can get to 1,000 pounds. But it's all fluff. They're trying to do the same thing with buffalo. They're trying to. But if you concentrate, if you have an animal that you're trying to butcher, that's you try to raise so much faster, it doesn't get to develop any of the structure. You can try the soup bone, broth bone stuff on these animals that are raised so much quicker and faster, and you're not going to get near the effect with the collagen ligament connective tissue for arthritis protection because they're trying to raise them too fast. If you have animals that are in extended families, they don't have to grow up quick. In the elephants in Africa, when they took all the mature males out, those young bulls, besides being delinquent, where they started killing all the rhinos, they came in must a lot faster. They grew a lot faster. So if you have an extended family with all the support system, they grow at the natural size rate that they should, like beef used to be. So it takes longer to raise buffalo to that 1,000 pounds. If you're looking at beef compared to buffalo.
Yeah.
But it's just like, you know, chickens, what? They get them in 30-some or 40 days. Yeah, it's huge amount of. You know, but there's nothing in it. It's just fluff. It's just, there's nothing nutrition in it. But that's what they're trading off. They're trading volume. It's no different than raising, you know, open pollinated corn compared to hybrid.
Yeah.
My dad said they tried to stay with open pollinated with their pigs because when they went to hybrid, they had to start feeding supplement.
Yeah.
The open pollinated corn, 30 bushels an acre. In the end, they had to go to hybrid because it was by weight is what they were selling it. But there's nothing in it. You get a small strawberry, wild one, that's got more nutrition, they found out, than in those huge, two of those big store-bought ones.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So you get an animal that grows up the same rate it's supposed to grow, and you get what you call a concentration of nutrients, which isn't any different than what...
Quality instead of quantity.
Yeah, that's right.
So... In school, everybody in the United States and probably all over the world learns about gravity. Anybody can learn about gravity. But Isaac Newton discovering it, that makes him a genius, right? Something so simple. And I think that not only are we hanging out with a legend, a park ranger legend who chased down poachers, who poached poachers, as I would say, that it's anybody can learn these things about buffalo, but to discover these things about buffalo, that kind of takes a genius. And we've talked on the phone, and I've read a bunch of your stuff, and I knew that hanging out with you would be a good time, but you have proven yourself to be more of a well of knowledge than I could have ever. I mean, just hearing you now, I know that, you know, there's decades and decades of information that we would never have time, you know, to uncover. I know you said you might not have time to write a book. I really hope you end up getting to writing a book, and I hope that movie comes to fruition. But usually, and we do need to come near an end here. I mean, we've been hanging out for a couple hours, which might be our longest podcast ever, which we're really
well worth it.
Yeah, it's been amazing. We usually ask one question, and that is, if you could snap your fingers and change one thing about this world, whether it's the way that humans think about something or it's practical, like maybe you want to change, you know, 20% of Iowa back to prairie. If you could snap your fingers and change one thing about this world, what would it be?
Living within your environment, your area. Once you live within it, without trying to exploit, that's where you get in trouble. I was fortunate in Yellowstone. There wasn't exploitation.
Hmm.
And so it means you don't make as much money.
Yeah.
You got to stick with your principles, your knowledge, what you have.
Yep.
Yellowstone, the buffalo, the bison biologists, they don't recognize. They have all these removal of excess bison each year. They're trying to get down to 3,000 or 4,000 instead of 5,000. They're destroying all the infrastructure. They're causing all the overgrazing. You talk to that guy who's been there 20 years, he says, we don't see family groups. We see some affinity up until their yearling age. He says, one time you go out, and there may be 40 or 50 in that group. Next time you go out, there's 60. Next time you go out, there's 20. They're just a mass of animals. And I said, they're just visiting their cousins. They're visiting their relatives. They're all part of about a 300-animal group. And so they're no different than the Indians, you know, where the young guys would maybe travel to Texas from Nebraska to see, you know, distant cousins and relatives. That's what you're doing. But they can't, because man thinks they're superior to everything out there in the world. As long as you have superior thoughts, the academic world is probably the worst world of all to learn from. And so, no, I'm not a genius at all. There isn't anything that I know that the Indians and any hunter-gatherer society knew a lot more than me. You just try to pick out a little bit. I mean, the head of the Utah State Range Science, Fred Provenza, he's known all over the world. He came to Yellowstone, and there were a bigger group of buffalo, 70 in Hayden Valley. There's a group about 25 or 30, about a mile away on the other side of the Yellowstone River. And I said, that group is with this larger group, is a matriarchal unit. Except the smaller group, of course, had two males in there with them. And I said, let's go to Canyon. We'll get something to eat. And I say, that smaller group is going to be coming across where this major group is. I said, the bigger group is heading up the valley. I say, we'll get back, and they're probably going to be crossing the Yellowstone River. I could tell 95% of what each animal was going to do. We come back an hour later. Here it is, that small group coming across. They're still dependent on that larger group. They're getting independence. But what you have, if you're an Indian, I realize they're not going to go after that main group. They're going to know where that smaller group is going to be coming. You just get yourself in a blind somewhere where you're concealed. You know that group is coming, and then you can get them. That's the knowledge that I didn't have and don't still have. They have so much more knowledge than what I ever would have.
Mm.
And you got to be humble. You don't have to be a genius at all. You just need to. And I was lucky. You know, the game wardens in the state, they hated Wyoming, Montana, Idaho, they did the principles of Yellowstone because their nature says it's the best way. Game wardens were the ones that set the seasons for the animals, the big game. All they think about is how many mature bulls you have for how many cows you have. If you have two or three mature bulls for six or for 100 cows, that's good. If that isn't going to take care of them, then those spike elk males can do it. In Yellowstone, everybody hates it. The wolf was reintroduced. But all those elk go out of Yellowstone. 18,000 elk in the northern herd. The wolves, they say, killed them all. Well, they did. But why? Because they had no protection left. None of the bulls are there because all the seasons are set to kill the males. And the males are what gives the rings of defense. We have one herd of 300 elk that stays in my area down in the Delta area of southeast arm of Yellowstone Lake. They winter there. They stay there year-round. The wolf packs come in. I'd be glassing for sheep poachers up in that country. And the wolf packs would come in. And there's rings of defense. I don't know if you ever, like Pablo Escobar, you know, where he is a cocaine dealer out of Colombia. Yeah. And he'd set up rings of defense with all his soldiers up to 20 miles out, 10 miles out, 5 miles out. So when the federal rallies would come in, then they'd be warned of when they're coming in. And that's what your males do. You got your matriarchal elk family group. Then you got your raghorns, your 4 to 5 points. They may be a quarter mile out from that matriarchal unit. Then you got the 6x6. There are 3-year-olds up to 6-year-olds. They may be a half mile out. There's less of them. Way out in the perimeter, that's your royals, your 7x8s. All the buffalo or the wolf packs that would come in to that herd, they could get through those big bulls because they might be a half a mile apart. But I never saw them once get through the 6x6s. And, you know, elephants, they could pound the ground with their foot and they could feel it or sense it 5 miles away. I couldn't hear anything. I don't know what those bulls were doing. But all at once, that cow-calf group would just run like hell up into the woods. The northern herd, where there's no males left on those elk herds, they went from 18,000 to 4,000. They have to put the males back in if they're going to protect from the wolf packs, which were a part of it. But how did the wolf packs, hundreds of thousands, millions of wolves, millions and millions of elk and buffalo, how did they do it, live together? You can't take the protectors out and think you're going to have a regular population of either one of those.
Man,
so
that is fascinating. You know,
you know what? It's the first time this was on. Well, I've said it before. I've written it, but yeah, do whatever you want with that information. The biologists aren't going to like hearing that.
Wow.
They don't want to because they think they're controlled by numbers.
Yeah.
They don't think of males. The main guy, trying to think of his name, University of California, Davis. He just died here some years ago. He's the main advisor for American Serengeti, where they're trying to reintroduce buffalo into Montana. He grew up on the bison range up there in Montana. His father was a manager. You read his books, and he did all his PhD in the social order, whatever, the life of buffalo. He thinks the males, the only thing they do is lay around and then wait for breeding season. That was his PhD. That's his books. And that was the advice he was given. It's so far off. No population is going to have something like that without the support systems.
Yeah.
The buffalo, when they'd move, the flankers were the ones on the side. That's where wolves come in. They protect each other. They get into solid groups of buffalo, unless they're a mountain buffalo. But anyway, most of the people don't even recognize that as a, they think that's an extinct buffalo. It's still there in Yellowstone. They run. They run when they see wolves or people because they can get caught. Kind of like the Western movies, you know, getting caught. You know, yeah, in some hole that they go into, but they get trapped. Yeah, well, that's what you have. You just, anyway, yeah. We can go on forever, but what you do is you read all the books on. Well, I'm getting out of here. Hold on. you sit on the John, you read these books. George Catlin, Episodes from Life Among the Indians and Last Brambles. That was the Indians he studied after went west in western United States, because he did all the drawings and paintings. He went into South America and studied the Indians there. And they would go after the wild cattle that would be out in the Pampas, Argentina. The exact same behaviors. Everything the Indians did there with wild cattle is what the Indians did with the bison and the elk here. You can read what the Indian food lore. This is a real good book. Heads, Hides, and Horns is probably the best book I've seen with the history of what buffalo are. The only thing that's wrong is the author makes assumptions that are totally wrong. But you get some of these books, you know, the early ethnology, you find a lot with a lot of the early African hunters. That's where you find out all this information. These books here are just copies. Most of the books have got little pieces of sticky paper all over the place. Some of them got toilet paper. You know where you...
Well, but that's on the John,
yeah. Well, that's where you learn is reading that stuff, and you don't have time otherwise.
You heard it here first, guys. You learn on the John.
Yeah. Well, in Thoroughfare, you learn on the outhouse, John. Yeah,
oh, yeah. The elevated outhouse.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, quick. I'll digress real quick on something. The wolves being reintroduced to Yellowstone, we don't really have time to dive into it right now, but if you haven't heard, we actually interviewed the gentleman who did it, Carter Niemeyer. We had him on interview, oh man, like first 15 episodes.
He's episode 8-ish somewhere.
Yeah, maybe that's the one I remember, because I didn't see it in your podcast. I didn't notice that.
He's a fascinating guy.
Big, tall guy. Big. He's a grizzly bear guy.
Yeah,
Carter Niemeyer.
He had some grizzly bear stories too on that episode. So if you didn't have a chance, go back and listen to that episode. He talks about being connected to the land, and I mean, just from all of us here at Hoxie and everyone else that's listening to this, thank you so much for giving us your time and your knowledge.
Yeah,
Let's go on a little bit. You can cut it out.
Yep.
Let's go more of what the prairie does.
Okay. we're here for it. It's your time. So. Yep.
This is part of the economics of it.
Oh, yeah. We're all about that.
What you guys are put in for people for seed, you know, your little gift of all the different plants is so and so important. If you have extended families, they're going to graze any of these introduced prairies a lot differently.
You're talking about extended families of buffalo.
Or cattle.
Or cattle, okay.
If you want to do it with sheep, pigs, any of that. It doesn't make any difference. Even chickens are families. They're all families. Everything has to be extended families. It's the only way that a species can keep going, evolved that way. Yeah. And to think that we don't think them that way and what the negative effects are that you do it. But with the prairie that you have, what you have with, like our buffalo skulls, they weigh a time and a half, almost two times as much as other buffalo skulls. Hmm. Why do they? Why so dense a bone? We had one guy is in Park City, Utah, and he's the one that has the grizzly bears in the movies, and he's got a wolf pack out there too. And he'd have to drug those two grizzly bears every month or two when he's doing film, because everybody wants to see the big white canine teeth. He couldn't get any bones or anything that they would chew on. They would pulverize them all. He heard about us and our buffalo, and he got a hold of us. And the bones from our buffalo, they could last up to a week. So he didn't have to tranquilize them and clean the tartar off of the teeth of those grizzly bears. Why are they so much more dense? It's because they've learned to eat from the broadleaf community. I talk about your mineral uptake. You won't have, which is pretty important for a lot of beef production. If you have the native plants that they know, see, ours are different than other buffalo because they've had the passed on knowledge of what to harvest from the forbs. And the forb seeds, or the forb roots, besides having lots of different more types of nutrient, they go so much, they go deeper than your prairie grasses do, the roots do. So they're getting even more mineral. So that's a huge difference of what, and then how you can apply that to us eating that. That's a big, big difference. So I don't know. Anyway, I wanted to tell you a little bit about the difference in the prairie and the production, what you can do with your animals. Yeah. So
that is super awesome. Yeah. So you're saying that if you're going to put out, you're going to put out pasture for any sort of grazing family, it needs to be heavily seeded with forbs. And we actually have started doing that recently. Here's the problem that we're finding is when people are raising cattle for money, which most people are raising cattle for money, nothing against them, but we have to convince them to stay off this prairie for 2 summers or a summer and a half, so it can get established. So their cattle, because they're not family, they're not being taught, they'll just overgraze it like a mower set on high or on low all the time. What would you say to that?
I'd say that's one of the few programs that I think is good. The CRP, if they could, if they have land that can go into CRP, even though they might be losing some money from what would be row crop, then they can have plenty of time to establish that prairie with all the forbs especially. And then, well, some of these areas, of course, like ours, you put fire out there and you find out what we're going to be going out to is a 280-acre field that was grazed by cattle for 100 years. You can bring back some of that stuff. It may not look like that much. They'll graze out the native grasses, but almost all those cattle, they didn't know what to eat. You know, they always were the calves taken off. So some of these areas where the people has just been grazed, they can actually reestablish them. And some of that, they can put...
Reconstruct or...
Well, you start putting the grasses in with the forbs that are there. And I haven't had the opportunity to do that, but that's what we need to be able to do.
Yeah.
That's always been my passion, you know.
Hey, talking to the mic here, if you're going to...
It's always been my passion to, you know, find some ground here in Southern Iowa that's always been grazed and try to clean it up, the woodies out of it, and try to get some of the native species to come back on its own. And it takes some grazing probably to do that, too.
Either that or you can start plowing down the steep hillsides and let the soil go down further. Yeah. You got your choice.
I like that part about going up and not doing anything. Back to the top, circle around.
Yeah. I saw that first person. I don't know, because I love that prairie hillside.
Horsepower to get her uphill. Rider fast going down.
Yeah.
Man. Uh-huh. All right, well.
My brother
else?
John, he's the one that put in the most beautiful prairie. Up there in our northern, but he's right here. John, you want to say something in here? Okay, he's modest. He doesn't want to. Sorry.
That's all right, John.
Yeah, okay.
All right. Well, okay. We are getting excited. We want to go see some of the buffalo. Is that all right?
Yeah, you're not going to see them so much in the family units. Right now, you might start to see nursery. We've had our first calf. But what you'll see is a support system out there. Once you have functional family groups, what you'll see is nurseries, just no different than what humans would do. You know, you'd have hunter-gatherers, one grandmother, whatever, would take care of all the very young, while the rest of them are, you know, eating, getting better shape for the breeding season, whatever coming up. So you have nursery groups, but then what about all the yearlings and the two-year-olds? While you have your nursery groups, then you have the yearlings and two-year-olds with the aunts, the grandmothers. They may be a quarter mile away from that nursery group. So they're supporting the young ones while the mother, when I was at Tom Brokaw's buffalo place, they had me could do some consulting. And there was one younger bull and one cow way off from the rest during the breeding season. And I say, why? Well, I said, they're eloping. I says that young cow can go back in that herd anytime she wants, but the bull can't compete with the others. So your bull support systems, your female part of the matriarchal units, they're all with the support system at that time of the year. So you get so much more advantage. You don't have near the cost involved. They don't have to eat as much. And if they did it with cattle, the first one, like I say, that can do that, and then you can have these dysfunctional herds of cattle. A rancher could put in a spinoff satellite group of 30 cattle. Disorder always seeks out order. The young cattle that they bring in around here, or cows, they always try to get in with our buffalo because that's order. They know
that's
that.
Very interesting.
So yeah. If you did it with cattle, they could put that in with the larger herds of cattle, dysfunctional, and they would be going to order. As long as they don't overwhelm them, they will support it. If they are already maxed out, then they're not going to accept them. But otherwise, they're going to learn from it. So, yeah, you could be a good system. And it's much more beautiful to look at these animals. Not only do the calves play, but the whole herd will play. Mm. That's a herd that doesn't have the stress, and that's what you can enjoy on, is what you can see.
So the enough cow thing, or today's cattle, you think that'll ever go to that family group?
They could still do it. People ask that. Have they been so far gone, removed? I tell you, it doesn't take pigs only a couple of generations, and you're back to the wild hogs. Mm. Cattle, they did it in the Aleutian Islands. Those are Herefords. Those are English.
So what would speed up that process? What would set the thing afire, you know, get people to do that? I mean, that's a hard thing.
In the end, you have to do, does the academics allow it to happen? Are they, you know, the study we had at Utah State, I was the one going around to all the different parks and state parks, anything with buffalo herds. They paid me to go around and try to find a functional group. We couldn't find any buffalo herds. And the group that we were going to use for the Ted Turners was out of New Mexico. I'd already done some talks with them. The most they did there is they didn't wean the calves. They kept them up to yearlings because it's such an arid country. In the end, the only herd that was good was Yellowstone, but their PhD candidate, his wife didn't want to live in Yellowstone. So what they do with science? They put that guy, their protege, to study that herd of Ted Turners in New Mexico as the herd that was functional. His PhD ending was, we see some signs of family groups. And that's because of the system and the academics. You got to be pretty modest and pretty humble. So in the end, how do you do it? You have to do it somewhere outside of science.
So
you
have to
have some people.
Get the consumer to demand this, or?
Well, they're going to have a lot better.
Yeah.
A lot better nutrients. Not a little more nutrient condensed. Yeah, it's going to have to come through. And that's what most all of our customers are. You know, they're into the health consciousness, and they're repeat customers for all those years. Yeah, so it's got to be coming from the consumer side. For what you guys are doing with the Prairie Seed, with the Forbes, you know, you look at how beautiful they are, the flowers and all that.
Right.
If you can get some masses where you can see everything like you do in Yellowstone, you know, where it's all one color together. Any of that stuff, all those historical accounts.
Well, getting into the, you know, into this native grass seed business that Hoxie's into, it was the beauty, the habitat. And there's so many spinoffs from that, for, you know, to this buffalo thing, to nutrition, you know, that's what totally amazed me about this native grass business, you know.
You know, the problem that you guys are having with, you know, how do you take that many years? I've had to have too many buffalo on too small of acres. Some of the areas that we drilled and replanted, if I leave them off a year, then all at once you can see the grass is coming in. They're still there, but you can't hardly see them. And so they've been hurt. You know, I hate seeing hurt
prairie. You're talking cool season grasses or native grasses?
Native grasses are okay. Still there. Like if you go to the west,
okay,
where we got these 400-year-old oak savanna trees, that was here when the Indians were all here. There's a stagecoach line that goes right by that big oak tree, you know, that we have here. I hate seeing for where I got the pictures of just pure. Some of that was never planted, you know, with the oak savannah trees. I don't see that much anymore. Mm-hmm. I hate it. So it is going to be a problem if all at once you had the COVID, you know, and that really hurt things. So now you don't have the live animal sales as much. You know, people got more secluded. So you do more of the meat sales. But, yeah, that's the customer. So luckily, and I could sell all the meat to one customer. But what do you do with one customer that's buying it all? You can't promote it. You can't get people to see it. Which would be the same in the seed production. You know, what if you can get some people, you know, to see all the butterfly weeds all together, you know, all those different things. I gave a presentation. They paid me $500. The road, all the counties have a road side.
Roadside management.
Yeah. And I told the lady in charge of that, the DOT, I says, like some of the hillsides, you know, because they put it along the roads, you know, in the interstates. I said, put it on the overpasses on those hillsides. Something like Missouri is doing, you know, where they're not all pure native down there, but it has an effect on you. So what you can see here in southern Iowa, you know, you got all the hills, put the dams up on all these people's farms, and then have a waterfall coming out into the ditch when you get the rains, you know, have a place there. And of course, it was just like I was talking to some other foreign country. They couldn't see the vision of it, you know, right. And so.
You could see the clean water coming off these fields rather than, you know, the muddy water, especially along Interstate 80, you know, through Iowa, I guess. They put all the roadside vegetation in the ditches where they need to get it out there in the field. And but right now all we see is corn, soybeans, and a little prairie in the ditches. And
well, when I moved to southern Iowa, it was because all the places we used to build to hunt pheasants and everything, along the fence rows, everything was taken out. There was nothing left. The pheasants were having to live in the gravel road ditches in the wintertime.
Yeah.
You couldn't do it. No. You know, I quit my hunting. I just went from, you know, hunting elk to hunting the hunters. That was a lot more rewarding. Yeah.
I think there's a famous short story about that, the most dangerous game or something. Yeah. But hey, guys, we actually have to wrap up because my computer is going to die, and then we will not save this podcast, and that would not be good. So, Bob, thank you so much. Thanks for hosting us, and we are excited. If anyone's curious, we'll have pictures on our. On our Instagram of what our little safari after this podcast was like. And don't forget, just as Bob was saying earlier, that it takes us to make a difference. It takes us deciding what's important to us. Is it going to be money, or is it going to be family and connectedness to what we're around?
Just as Bob has shown for us, conservation happens one mind at a time.